Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 46.
46.
What a week we've had.
What a week. We got married.
Hitched.
We got married.
In Brooklyn. We could have gone to Vegas to do it even quicker.
But yeah, we did it in Brooklyn, and I have no voice still.
Yeah, I think we're still in recovery mode. The, like, 18 months of planning sort of crashed down all after it was finished, feeling that tiredness.
Yes, but it went very well. We did our first dance. We had a flower girl malfunction. This little girl named Zoe, who's a family friend of ours, daughter, she was the cutest flower girl ever.
Two and a half.
Yeah, two. So the terrible twos, and just has a real strong will of her own. And her mom was holding her while we were waiting behind the curtain to go out for the ceremony. And it was just like, everyone was like, Lindsay, what do you want to do with this flower girl? She's not going to do it. I was like, she's two, like, she'll do whatever she's going to do. So they're like, okay, Zoe, it's almost Zoe's turn. You can put her down. And they put her down, and she runs out before my last two bridesmaids and just runs down the aisle and runs up onto the stage.
Yeah, she grabbed my hand, came on stage. It was really cute.
It was really cute. But then, because she didn't take the, you know, do the flower girl duty of throwing the flowers or the confetti as we had, my little godson, who was my ring bearer, was like, I can do it. He's four. And he took the bag of confetti and just plopped it out because his mom was like, you cannot throw the confetti at anyone. So the way he did it was like, I don't care about this confetti, drop. It was really amazing.
Yeah, it was a really fun weekend. And what made the weekend doubly awesome is we got two more fantastic reviews for our show in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
The Misbehave game show, now playing at Bally's. Las Vegas Review Journal, I think, probably had my favorite opening paragraph of any review. I'm going to read it right now. It's like a teenager's house party after mom and dad have left for the night, combined with the vibe of a really hip cabaret, presented as a sort of show that apocalypse survivors would enjoy if they needed a few laughs. And that's all meant in a totally complimentary way. So I love that. It definitely has that house party, house party feeling, and the post-apocalyptic feeling, which, you know, you and I have talked about the podcast before, our love of post-apocalyptic themed things.
Yeah, it's awesome. And we also got a really good review in Las Vegas Magazine.
Yeah, the title of it was Shyness is Nice Unless You're at the Misbehave Game Show. And I like this one a lot, too. It's not as witty as the Vegas Review Journal, but a really positive one. We posted both of them to the Hideaway Circus Facebook page. So if you're curious and reading more, need more help in making your decision when you go to Vegas and have to pick which show to see, make sure it's Misbehave Game Show.
There's a photo. I think it's in the Las Vegas Review article, but it's a photo of the show, and there's this like middle-aged woman on stage. I think she's dancing. She has a banana in her hand, and it just looks like, I'm like, I want to go to the show because I want to see what that moment is like. What was she doing? How did she get on stage? And the dance move she's doing, I don't understand how she's doing it.
No, I don't understand either. For those of you who maybe this is the first time tuning in, the Misbehave Game Show is a combination cabaret show and comedy show that we have playing in Vegas. The premise is that the audience is split into two halves, people who have iPhones and people who don't. And everybody plays really, really silly games. They get more and more competitive, and the points are meaningless. Just as sort of an example of what the games are, there's, you know, shout the loudest, followed by shout the quietest. Mm-hmm. You know, so things that are super easy, stupid, but, you know, are guaranteed to make you laugh. Plus, something we can't not have in our shows, a handful of really, really good circus acts that change every month. So if you saw it, you know, last month, you want to go see it again, you'll see brand new numbers.
Yeah, that's great. Good reviews.
Keep them coming.
Yeah. some other news. There are two new articles about Big Apple Circus.
Yeah, tell me about them, Lindsay.
One of the articles is about the city of New York, the Department of Cultural Affairs, back in 2011, apparently bought one of the Big Apple circus tents for $929,000.
So you're saying that the city owns a circus tent?
Yeah, the city owns a circus tent, and they're trying to figure out what to do with the tent. And they want to make sure it's still used for public for public use.
Interesting.
What? So did Big Apple have three tents?
I don't know. Big Apple's had a few tents over their lifetime. Maybe it's a previous tent before that.
It looks like an old one. Maybe it's like a white one with yellow stars.
If anybody has more scoop on this, definitely shoot us an email. hello@hideawaycircus.com. We'd be interested in maybe using a tent or at least hearing more about what this opportunity is.
Yeah. What's not said in this article, which I feel like is maybe an indicator of why they bought the tent, is the only reason you sell something is because you need cash, right? Or you need money. And selling one of your circus tents, you know, is like indicative of that. So maybe in 2011, they were still having, that was like the start of, wasn't that what they cited as like when their financial issues started?
Yep.
So it seems like this has been obviously going on since 2011. It was nice of the city to buy the tent. I'm surprised they haven't done anything with it or told anyone about it till now. But it's interesting if it has the Big Apple logo on it, which it does, what that's going to do if you have two Big Apple circus tents like in the New York area and one is the show and one is just like
this extra tent with the old logo on it.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
It is kind of weird.
But yeah, we'll see what
happens with that. The other article seems to be harking back to something that Big Apple has a problem with every year. What's the second one about?
People, as always, are up in arms about the circus being in a public space.
In Damrosch Park and Lincoln Center.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is with this stuff, you're always going to get those whiny people that are like annoyed that you're taking up their space. But on the flip side, like they're providing arts and culture and a show, and their tickets are starting at $35 to families to provide for circus. You know, like
just playing devil's advocate though for these people who are complaining.
Sure, let's play devil's advocate, Josh. Let's do that. Let's argue.
Okay, well, here's the first part. It's loud. Like the tent's canvas, you got a live band. Shows are happening at like 11, 2, and 6, so all day, sometimes, you know, later in the evening. And the sound leak, if you live in an apartment that's around Damrosch Park, is pretty bad. Also, Damrosch Park has like fun activities in it when it's not turned over for Big Apple Circus for 3 or 4 months of the year. You know, I've been there before where they sort of have like big group tango salsa dancing that happens. Mm-hmm. Granted, Big Apple is there when it's cold and when it's in the winter, so maybe the park is less usable. But parks are public space. And I would feel less like this is a problem if it was truly like an arts organization that was a nonprofit going into the space like it had been in the past. Because at the end of the day, it's not about making money. It's about providing circus and then the mission that Big Apple has. But now that Big Apple is for profit, that sort of seems, you know, a little inconsistent. Like we have a for-profit thing going into a park, preventing public use for a couple months. I totally get this is where they've been coming from.
Actually, it's cheap tickets. So I actually wish I was arguing your side because I agree with everything you said. But just to play devil's advocate for fun, Lincoln Center is an arts institution and circus inherently is part of the arts, right? And has to be. It has to continue to be a part of the arts. And circus can't go to many places, especially in New York City. So if Lincoln Center doesn't allow them to come, then where are you going to put a circus tent? And especially in a really special area like Lincoln Center. Like, if they don't allow the circus tents to keep coming there, then there's a massive chance of circus tents being just another thing of the past or a place that you go when you're not in a city. So I think it's really important that Lincoln Center is making a stand and saying like, no, this is something that is part of our commitment to the community as providing arts. And yeah, it's a for-profit company now, but it's still providing the same exact thing that it was, except for the clown care aspect, but it's providing the same show.
Well, we'll see about that.
I mean, it's the same team, you know, but it's still providing a show for lower ticket prices. It's not like coming in and being like a Cirque du Soleil show where this lowest ticket price is like $79. You know, it still is theoretically affordable for a family. And that's also important. And yes, it's loud, but New York City is loud. Nailed it.
Let us know what you think. Shoot us an email at hello@hideawaycircus.com with your opinions on Big Apple Circus. Or if you have a really good idea of what to do with their tent, also let us know.
With
their Big Apple tent. One more thing we wanted to plug before we get into our interview. This festival that we're participating in October, called the Future of Storytelling Festival, or FOST for short. We partnered with them last year to do a few promotions with Slumber. And this year, we're actually doing a talk and sort of mini show for them called The Future of Circus, where Lindsay and I will be talking about...
The future of circus.
Plenty of ideas that, you know, our regular podcast subscribers are familiar with, but sort of more focused on what we think is going to be happening in the next couple of years and where the industry is headed. Plus... some of the best acts from Slumber. We have our friends from Australia coming in. We got this crazy juggler, really good hand-to-hand acts. So if you also want to come and see some of our favorite super high-end circus acts, grab your tickets. I believe it's FOST.org. We should be on the front page, so you'll have no problem sort of navigating and trying to figure out how to get tickets to that. Should be pretty fun.
On our podcast today, we interviewed Randy Weiner.
Has been one of the guests that I most look forward to having on the podcast for, I don't know, since we started it. Randy was my old boss. He started The Box, which most circus performers know of. But he's also the main producer of Sleep No More. He did Queen of the Night, which is a circus show in Times Square. He originated The Donkey Show, which was the first sort of immersive nightclub kind of performance back in the 90s that's played all over the place, including in New York and in Boston. He's done shows in Vegas and in Dubai, just all over the world.
Randy's also married to a really influential theater director who I'm obsessed with, Diane Paulus, who we've talked about before. I love talking to couples who work together and create together and are artistic together because it's a very rare and interesting relationship, and they've known each other since high school. And it's a really nice story, which we talk about on the podcast.
As we do usually, we start off talking about people's backstories, and that's a good first half of the episode. But we go on to talk about sort of Randy's creation process and how do you sell and discuss and market a show that is hard to describe. We talk about lots of really, really interesting sort of big picture questions at the end, too. So if you like us,
make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com. Here's our episode with Randy.
So did you grow up in New York City, Randy?
I grew up in Washington. Well, I would lie and say yes normally, but I'll try and be very truthful with you guys. This will speak to how truthful I'm going to be. I was born in Washington, D.C., and I lived in a place called Rockville, Maryland until I was 7 years old. And then we moved to New York.
What prompted the move?
My father, every sort of Jewish lawyer who grew up poor dreams of working at a big New York City law firm. So he grew up very poor in Philadelphia, but he had this sort of strain of being like a do-gooder and wanted to change the world. So he went to work for the government at first and worked with like Bobby Kennedy, like had this incredibly cool job working for like unions and civil rights and all that stuff. But then he got this offer to work at this law firm in New York. So my dad took this job and he moved us all up here. And then I don't know what happened, but basically a week into his having the job, he lost the job. So as an adult now, I wonder what the hell happened there. I'll never know. He kind of explained it. It's like looking back and it doesn't really make sense. He's like, well, the guy who left decided to come back. But that, you know, who the hell knows what happened. So then we were sort of stuck in New York and, you know, it was a weird time. It was 1972. And, you know, New York was really in a terrible place, like in the 70s. So I went to PS6, this public school. And in 75, and this, I'm telling you this because I think this makes me the most New Yorker. In 75, there was a very famous thing that happened where the president was Gerald Ford. And the city was defaulting on all of its loans. And the city was like, oh my God, we can't pay our, you know, because then people stopped loaning money to the city. We were like, we can't pay our teachers, we can't pay our police, we can't pay our firefighters. And Ford said, usually like the government would bail a city out, but Ford was like, I'm not going to bail you out. So the famous cover, if you're from New York at that time, literally the Post wrote Ford to city drop dead in like huge letters. So everyone who was around that, like New York lived with that scar for a long time. I mean, like, it's funny, like, you guys come here. Where are you from again, Josh?
Connecticut.
You know, like, you guys come here, like, you want to be in New York, but that was the time when no one wanted to be in New York. You know what I mean? Like, right. No one. And actually, it was the critical time, because out of that, you know, all these amazing things happened, because no one wants to be here. It's a total wasteland. And then you've got hip-hop coming out, and disco, and all these amazing things. But for me, when he said drop dead, they couldn't pay the teachers. So in an amazing thing, we had 2 weeks off of school, because they just... that's the way they dealt with the budget crisis. And I just think about that now also as a parent. I'm like, what the hell did my parents do? And they were right. Like, okay, you've got three little kids. They're like off of school.
Where are you and the three kids?
Middle.
The middle child.
The most,
the one who's forgotten about.
Well, that's what they always say. I guess if you're also in the middle, you try to succeed, to stand out. I have no idea. You know, I don't believe any of that stuff.
So what was the thing you saw that got you excited about theater?
Well, I really don't like theater. You know what I mean? I think I live a life that proves that I don't really like theater that much. But my father loved theater. And I think my dislike of so much of theater came from my dad because he took us to so many shows. My father loved theater. He grew up, like I said, speaking Yiddish in Philadelphia, you know, the youngest kid. It's funny, like no one paid attention to him. He tells us, being the youngest kid, you know, no, they were, his parents were so sick of kids at that point. But he like fell in love with the theater. He would like come up to New York on a bus, you know, to see a Broadway show and see all the tryouts in Philadelphia, because Philadelphia used to be a big tryout town for Broadway. So he loved theater. We would go to theater all the time growing up. Like, I can't express to you. Like,
what's like the show that you remember thinking, I really don't like this, when you were a kid? Or I really love this?
It's so funny you say that, because it wasn't like one show made me not like it. But I think it's a little bit like anytime your parents make you do something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would see two shows every Saturday, two shows every Sunday.
It was a lot for someone who loves theater.
We didn't go to church or temple or, you know, we went to the theater. So it's like that same feeling of, oh my God, I'm sitting here in the dark, you know, watching this thing. So I think it was over time, everything just started to feel the same to me.
Right.
I think that was more.
Were you seeing mostly traditional and air quotes traditional
stuff?
Well,
to my dad's credit,
too?
And I give him a lot of credit for this, he would see anything. So we would go see things like, you guys won't even know what this is, the Ridiculous Theater, which was this insane, like, gay-focused troupe down in the Lower East Side. And it would be like he'd drag all, and I promise you, we were the only kids, like, sitting there, like, watching, like, Charles Ludlam, who was a very famous sort of stalwart of, like, you know, downtown theater, being dragged, play a million roles, run around, make all these, you know, crazy downtown edgy jokes, sexual, gay, you know, like all sorts of crazy shit. We were just sitting there, you know, watching it. So actually, I would say I enjoyed that stuff more because it was, you know, more surprising. My dad took me to a Eugene O'Neill show. I'll never forget this. In a loft, because there was a thing, TDF. You guys probably know what it is, right? So TDF, like, was, I don't know where it was in its life cycle then, but my dad would just see everything. If it was TDF, you know, he'd go see it. So we went to see a version of Emperor Jones. Do you know that play?
No. Mm-hmm. Eugene O'Neill play?
You know, Asher's not part of this
interview. Asher's in this interview as well.
Asher, do you know Emperor Jones? So sad, really. And you guys are actually educated.
I know.
It's kind of extraordinary, really, because my education is just from experience. Like, I studied biochemistry and psychology. Never studied any theater. But Emperor Jones, except with my dad, right? So Emperor Jones was this, do you know Harry Ape?
Yes.
To New York? Do you know about that show? That's another Eugene O'Neill. So it's a very expressionist show. And Emperor Jones was from that time, and it tells the story of this African Caribbean dude who just perceives himself as being the emperor and taking over for the natives, but he always is fearful that they're going to come and, you know, revolt against him. It's like a typical saga of being a dictator, right. And then the people are ultimately going to revolt against you. So during the show, there's like a drum beat. This was his like expressionist idea. There's a drum beat that through the entire show gets faster and faster. It's like an hour and a half show.
Oh my gosh.
And for 90 minutes, it's like boom, boom, until by the end, boom, 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 boom. So you feel like the natives are, you know, restless. So we saw that show in a loft in Soho. I promise you, when Soho was not the Soho you know, when Soho was like just bombed out.
And you could get a loft in Soho.
Exactly. Right. Where like an artist would get a loft in Soho and have... When it would be like the farthest reaches of Brooklyn, you know what I mean? To go to Soho. And I'll never forget this. They had like all these tree stumps all over. And we go into the audience and we were the only two people there. It was like one of those kind of things, you know, which I've done many shows like that. But like, I went to that show and we sat there, my dad and I, and there was like, you know, this big African-American dude running around playing like the crazy Emperor Jones and the drum beats are going, and we sat on these tree stumps and watched, just like the two of us, this like weird
amazing.
So when you say like, what do I remember? I remember that was pretty fucking awesome. But you know, wasn't like the awesomeness wasn't from the theater of it, and it wasn't even theater. I mean, it was like this weird O'Neill thing. It's why you guys don't know it, you know. You know Longest Journey Tonight, you ever hear that little show?
Yeah.
Exactly. So like, you know, like this was a weird experimental time
right.
in his life.
So in high school, were you pursuing theater or were you interested in other things?
I can't express to you how much theater is not part of life. It's so funny.
When Josh keeps trying to make you
theater,
be like,
when you know, say, theater is the bigger term of like live performance,
well,
circus,
in
unusual
in
things.
In high school, no. In high school, I just wanted to be a scientist. Like, you know, I was like very good at science and math, and I liked sports.
What sports did you play?
In high school, I did track, cross country, basketball, tennis.
Did you just bike here for this interest?
Yes, I bike everywhere.
So you like the long distance?
I like everything. I'll play. We want to have basketball right now. We'll get down. You want to play tennis right now? All those things I still do. It's great, like a lot. Yeah.
And I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but I haven't heard anywhere your origin story of how you met Diane in high school.
Okay, great story. So I can't express to you how the whole world of theater was not part of my world. Like I would just study, you know, totally study. Like anyone who knew me would be like, Ray is the biggest nerd in the world.
Well, you were majoring in science and math. So
well,
that's not
in high school. And you know, doing all those things. And, you know, I had my friends, but it was like all my sports friends and we'd joke around and be idiots and had no sensitivity to anything in the world. You know what I mean? Like we didn't care about anything. I remember one time a friend of mine watching like a beer commercial and a friend goes, that's so sexist. And I never even thought about other people or sexism. I don't know how to describe it to you. I was like, I'll never forget that moment. I was like, I was like, this is great. All these girls are jumping around in bikinis. I love this commercial. And then he's like, that's really sexist. And it was like, oh my God, those are people. I don't know. It was like, so that's how insensitive. I'm just telling you about the world I'm coming from. So then it's not like the good, like I just remember the theater kids, like, you know, about human relations and caring about the world being better and stuff like that. Actually can attest to my lack of sort of sensitivity of anything. But I got injured. I forget what I was doing. I got injured for whatever sport I was supposed to play. I was injured. And I was like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do now? And a friend of mine goes, oh, you could be it. Because I went to all boys school. He goes, you could be in a show at this girl's school. And I was like, why the fuck would I ever want to do that? And he's like, well, you could meet a girl. And I was like, all right, you know, fine, I'll do that.
How old are you? Is this like freshman year or senior year?
This is senior year. This is like in the
fall. Oh my God, you got injured senior year.
Yeah, so I'm like, so it was depressing. It was really, I was really depressed. So he was like, do that. So then I went to this girl's school called Brearley. So I went to this boys school called Collegiate. And I went to Brearley, and of course they take every guy. And I cannot express to you how bad an actor I am. Like I'm terrible, terrible memory. I start smiling in the middle of a scene. You know what I mean? Like we're like acting something dramatic. I don't know. I'm like I can't just get in there and just be there. It's like two in my head. So I have, if there's like five policemen, we're doing Wonderful Town. If there's like a thing for five policemen, I would be policeman number six. You know what I mean?
Like,
you know
what I mean? Like, make a perfume. Right.
Exactly. And you're the guy who walks on at the end and stays way in the back. Whereas
like,
Diane,
over
of course,
a little bit more in the wing a little bit, please.
Whereas Diane, of course, is the star of the show. Right. So I'm sitting there, and there was like another one of my friends. And like I said, all I cared about was joking around and fooling around. So the whole time I was fooling around. I have no interest in any of it. And somehow Diane became interested in me, which is such an insane thought. And then I don't know, that was it. I met her senior year in high school. She was a junior then.
Was the show Our Town?
It was Wonderful Town.
Oh, Wonderful Town,
Wonderful Town. Yeah. So it was like a happy musical.
Oh. I was like, Our Town's a pretty depressing.
No, it was a happy ending and all that stuff. So yeah, I would be in a conga line. I don't know. I honestly, it's a really crazy thought that I met her that long ago.
A good thing you got injured.
If you look at it that way, yeah, it certainly affected my life.
So after high school, you go to college, you're studying biochemistry, science in general.
Yeah.
What was the thing that pulled you back towards live performance? I heard somewhere that you have a Fugees connection in there somewhere as well.
Well, that's not till I got out of school. Like when I first, in school, I'm being a biochem major, and that was like a pretty, I was just talking to this kid from Harvard here yesterday. I guess they don't have it anymore. I couldn't quite understand what he was saying, but it used to be like the hardcore, if you were like a hardcore biology and a hardcore chemistry, you would be like biochemistry. It was like one of these honors. So it was like, I was very competitive. So I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be in biochemistry. So I was in this major and it was brutal. It was brutal. And like, I was taking these classes like in math where you're studying like the 25th dimension and how to represent like vector calculus. And it was so hard. And then Diane is doing like theater. So I'd be like up all night in the lab, like, you know, literally watching mold grow, like, you know, penicillin spores or something like that, and counting whether they were green or blue. God. And I remember literally I was up one night, all night long, and I saw Diana breakfast at her door, and she was like, how was your night? And I was like, are you kidding? I literally spent the entire night watching mold grow. And she was like, oh, I had the best night. She's saying, like, it was so fun. And Jeffrey told the funny, and it's funny, I still remember this kid, Jeffrey, telling that she quoted this kid, Jeffrey, which means nothing to you, but means a lot to me. She's like, Jeffrey told the funniest joke. And I was like, oh my God, am I doing something completely wrong with my life? Like, I was like, she's having just fun, you know, happy little stories, and I'm watching mold grow. So literally on a dime, I was like, I'm going to get into theater. Like, it was more just like, I'm going to do this.
You're like, who's Jeffrey?
No, I wasn't worried about that. I knew Jeffrey. Don't worry about Jeffrey. That was a red herring that made you guys nervous. Oh, yeah, Jeffrey is a constant struggle with Jeffrey. And I had to be a great artist. No, Jeffrey was just a guy who told a funny joke. Friend of mine, totally fine. All good. But, you know, so that's what happened. I just sort of switched on a dime, and I took a year off. I was like, listen, I don't want to do this anymore. I took a year off. And when I got back to New York, I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do in New York? So my dad, of course, loves theater. He's like, oh, you should go work at this theater and read scripts. So it was this theater called Ensemble Studio Theater.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, they were actually just at Ryder Space.
Ryder Farm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was like a successful one act. That's their niche, is doing these one acts. So I would read scripts there because they were always happy to have people to read scripts. And for whatever reason, you know who the literary manager was Desi Moynihan.
Oh my God. So
when I see Desi, she's like, Randy, because like she hired me as like this intern.
Oh my gosh.
Desi is the best, like so smart.
So cool.
So good. I loved her. So honestly, I mean, just like anything, it's about the people you meet. Mm-hmm. So I think I was there at a time. She was in charge. I was in this office, you know, for a year with Desi. And I had an amazing time. She's so smart, so good, just fascinating, interesting person. So I ended up having a great time. So I was like, all right, you know, this is fun. This is easy, you know, compared to like watching mold grow.
Right.
So then when I got back to college, I was always into hip hop. So that was the thing. That was probably the third. If it was like sports, school, and like hip hop music, you know, growing up in New York. Like my first date with Diane, I took her to a Run DMC concert at the Roxy, which means nothing to you because you don't know what the Roxy was.
No, but I know who Run DMC is, and I just imagine that.
So this is Run DMC's first concert. I would be listening to like WBLS or WKTU, which was like where like the Sugar Hill Gag would start. I'd be like, oh my God, I love this music. And they would say, we got these two kids from Queens who are coming to perform in New York for the first time. I was like, oh shit, Run DMC's coming, I gotta go. So I literally go there, and it's like me, Diane, and we got two of our friends to go. And it was like all just straight up hip-hop, ghetto-fied, Mandinka Warriors patting you down. She was like, what the hell are you doing taking me this place? So I always had all this hip-hop stuff going on. And when I was in college, I did a hip-hop musical. Like I was like, oh my God, I love hip hop music, and why can't they do shows that have music that I like?
So you were like way ahead of Hamilton.
Yes, there's an article about that actually.
Really?
Yeah. In what's that rap genius and now called Genius? You ever see that?
Yeah.
This guy just did an article about that. It's like 25 years before Hamilton.
What was the plot of the hip hop?
Well, the one we did in college was my roommate. He was like, let's do, because we were like, what are the things that are cool in hip hop? We were like, fashion. I don't know. We had all these ideas. So we're like, let's do The Emperor's New Clothes. So we created this thing, The Gag's New Thread. So it's like a huge, so we cast, I don't know if you guys know anything about hip hop, but like there was a magazine called The Source that was like the first magazine about hip hop.
Okay.
It was a hugely important magazine in the history of hip hop. If you're like a hip hop head, you'd be like, oh yeah, The Source. So those were my friends who made The Source. Like it's weird because I'm of an age where like all the sort of signature things of hip hop. If we were here with almost any hip hop kid, like literally, as Asher knows, I'm going to see ASAP Rocky today. You know who ASAP Rocky is?
I know.
So when I talk to ASAP Rocky and I go, yeah, I was down with guys with The Source, he's like, oh man. You know, it's like he's talking to like a direct line to his, like, I'm like the Dalai Lama or something. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, those guys were my friends. So we did this show together and, you know, it went really well. And it went so well. In fact, we toured it to Yale. Bam! That's how what a success it was. That's what it is.
Asher went to Yale.
Yeah, I threw it up at him. So then when we got out of college, so we graduated, and then we're like, oh my God, that was such a success. That was so fun. Let's do that again. So then my college roommate and I went around to all these clubs in the middle of the night. And when I think about it, it was so crazy. We were like these two white guys in like an edgy time in New York, going out to all these like hip hop clubs, and we'd show up and be like, give up these kids these flyers and be like, hey, you know, because you know, you'd see the ciphers, they'd be rapping or they'd be breakdancing. We'd like see a guy in the middle, we'd be like, you're awesome. Here's a flyer. And we got all these kids to show up, and we did this hip hop musical in New York based on 12th Night called Club 12. And it was just the two of us. No one could have cared less. We're just doing it with these kids. None of them had ever acted. And, you know, we just cast individually, like this guy, Nell Jean, who would go on to be Wyclef Jean. And we cast this girl, Lauryn Hill, who would go on to be Lauryn Hill. They didn't know each other. So we introduced them. So whenever they talk about the food, she's like, oh, yeah, we met doing this play, you know.
That's so crazy.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Club 12.
Club 12, that's it. So then we did that show. And then it was like a big hit with young people. Like, against any rational, like, no, I can't express it. It was like his grandfather gave us $2,000. And we, like, made the $2,000, like, last, like, buying these kids lunch or paying for their tolls or whatever we did to make it happen. So then we got flown to Hollywood. It was like huge. It was like Quincy Jones. All these people came in and saw this hip hop musical like, that came out of nowhere.
Did it have immersive elements the way a lot of your work does?
Not at all. Not at all. But just the fact that it was a hip hop musical was so fucking crazy. I can't express to you. Like all these guys like Gerald Schoenfeld and Bernie Jacobs. All Bernie Jacobs was still alive. They came to see the show. And I remember these old guys sitting there. And all the kids, they were like, we have no idea what's going on here. But that crowd was going crazy.
At the time, did you know who they were? Or you just like,
I had no idea who they were. I had no idea who they were.
And now looking back, you're like, wow, they came to see my
Well, it was even crazier because it's like we had Peter Guber. I mean, everyone came to see that
show. Oh, my gosh.
It was bananas. Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy.
And what year was this then?
This is 1991. So then I did that. And then I wrote in Hollywood for 3 years after that because it was always like hip-hop was like sort of just happening. And they would always be like, we want to get the guys who did Club 12. And I think they would always be surprised to meet me and my college roommate who went to Harvard. And we'd go to these dinners with these in all these fancy restaurants. And they'd always be like, so what are the kids in the ghetto want? We'd be like, we're like two guys from Harvard. You know, right. We like this. So we wrote all these things. We made all this money. And they would never make anything because it was all a little bit ahead of its time. But I would send these checks home to my mother because I was living in, you know, L.A. and my bank didn't talk to the L.A. banks. And she'd be like, what are you getting this money for? I was like, I don't know.
I don't know.
They just keep paying us to do these rewrites and rewrites. So then I think I just got frustrated because I didn't really go in it for money. I didn't even go in it to be in theater. Like, I can't explain the whole thing. So aberrant because we'd go to these meetings and you'd meet, like, the head of wardrobes and be like, so what's your dream project? I was like, I have no dream project.
I
used to watch Mold Grow, so I don't know.
Yeah, I should have used that. Like, good one. I wish I'd said that. Yeah, I have a very low bar. I should have said that. So then I was still, you know, going out with Diane. She was in New York and she was making this little theater, you know, that was going to be in Wisconsin because her mentor, this guy Paul Sills, had started Second City.
Mm-hmm.
So the Second City's, you know, started in Chicago. She was all into improv, Diane. So their summer house for all these Chicago people was in Wisconsin. So there's no reason, you know, Door County, Wisconsin. This little, like if Wisconsin looks kind of like a mitten, it's like the thumb part. So it's beautiful. It's like all on the water. It's like a Cape Cod of Wisconsin. So she was going out there. She's like, Randy, why don't you join me? I was like, oh, my God, me, I'm a big Hollywood celebrity. Why am I going to go out to some stupid thing and do a improv with you people? But I think, like I said, she did it 1 year, and then I got frustrated, and I was like, I'll just go do it. I remember my agent, a big agent at CA, he was like, what are you, crazy? You're going to Minnesota. I'd be like, no, I'm going to Wisconsin. He'd be like, it's even worse. What's wrong with you? So, but I sort of just left all that, and I started doing these shows with Diane, like these weird.
When she came and lectured at Columbia, she made it sound like the most, like, fun, formative time of her life.
Was that time in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
It was really fun. That's the thing. It was so fun because it was the antithesis of Hollywood. Hollywood, all this money, all these movies. There, it's like we're going to fish boils or going to, like, I'm convincing bar bands to do, like, rock musical versions of The Tempest. We did this thing, Prospero's Revenge. And they were like, there's the biggest bar band in Wisconsin. All these Harley Davidson biker guys. So it's so unlikely also. Like, so I was like, you deal with them. So I like would go hang out with these guys. And for whatever reason, I really got along well with them. I love those guys. Like to this day, I love those guys. And we'd be going to bars. I don't even drink. We'd be like drinking on their Harleys, the whole thing, tattoos, you know, big handlebar mustaches. But we just would make shows. We'd be like, all right, let's make a show in the bar. And they'd be like, cool. Like, they were, like, so open-minded. We would do, oh, my God, it was hilarious. We would do shows, like, we would see a beach on, like, Michigan. We'd be like, let's do a show there. So it was, I can't tell you, like, if Hollywood was just getting paid and never did anything, here was, like, anything we wanted to do, we somehow convinced everyone to do it. And it was weird. It was almost like, because Diane and I kept saying, why would we never be this way in New York? It was like, in New York, we would always think, well, this can't happen. But there we had no sense of reality, so everything was possible.
Right.
And we just kept doing stuff. We did a show on the beach. I had to convince the board of the beach, which was all these farmers, that we should do it. And I can't express to you, I go to this thing and usually they're like cow manure, like literally everything. And I'm in there, I'm like, we'd like to do a version of Beethoven's Ode to Joy set on your beach and using your water. So we're gonna have to close down. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And someone had warned me, they all like the Packers. And they, which is, you know, if you guys, I don't know if you know.
Football team.
Yeah, in like Wisconsin, that's like it. So I was like, yeah, and you know something, I think we've done some interesting planning because I know the Packers, we're doing this summer, I know the Packers have a preseason game, and I don't want to like compete with that because no one will come, and they were like, and as soon as I said Packers and said that, they all, that's good planning, son. And it was like, all these dudes in the overalls, I'll never forget that also. So we just, I mean, we have so many great memories of Wisconsin because it was just complete freedom, craziness, and doing so much shit.
And eventually you're just like, I gotta get back to New York.
No, Diane was, I loved it. So like by the end, they were like, we have a cheese factory we're gonna give to you. And there was one like wealthy artistic family, and we were doing very out there kind of shows, like really crazy shows. And they were like we would go, they had this big auditorium. And I went to the auditorium. I could be like, it was like I was like Peter Sellers or something to them. Like I was like, instead of doing the audience in the audience area, let's put everyone on the stage and we'll lower the grid and it'll feel like it's a science lab. And they're like, oh my God. You know, like we were doing just everything was so out there and crazy. And this person was like, I want to buy, and this is like this very wealthy family that had a country house there who saw, they're like, we're going to buy you this cheese factory and you're going to live here forever. And I remember being there with Diane looking at the cheese factory and it was incredible because they were like, this is going to be a place, a mecca, you know, like that right. Everyone, it would be like Bard colleges, no? Yeah. Like, a place that's outside in the summers, it would have been amazing. But Diane chickened out. She was like, I'm going to graduate school. I don't want to get stuck, you know, in Wisconsin. So I was like, all right. So then I had sort of burned a lot of bridges or like was kind of over LA. So then I moved to New York and I was like, what the hell am I going to do in New York now? And then I just got into the internet because the internet also had this fun thing at that time. This is like 96, 97, 98, 97, 98. Internet was just sort of coming up and I had worked with all these Hollywood people. So I was able to go to them and they'd be like, Randy, you're interested in coming out here? I'm like, nah, but I'm doing websites now. You want me to make your website? So every company, I did a website for New Line, for Miramax. So we made this website company that was like the hottest website company doing all the entertainment sites.
Whoa.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So I kept like jumping, sort of using what I'd done and then sort of recasting.
I don't want to jump too far forward, but I would say that the Box website and Safe No More websites are also both amazing, like, extensions of the ticket buying.
Yeah, yeah. Experience. So I was always very sensitive to that. I think I've always had a good sense of websites. But, you know, it's sad because now I am getting older. So it's like now I've lost it. I've lost my sense of what's going on. Like, it's like
you've lost
Instagram. I don't know. Like, I'm not quite on, like, what's really going on with Snapchat and all that shit. But that's
Snapchat's
fine.
Kind of waning. It's really Instagram stories.
Is, like, comeback. No, I know that from a macro level. But how they use it, like, the tonality of it. Mm. Like, how to do something that's, like, kind of the opposite. But you know what I mean? Like, which is what – when we did the Box one, I mean, that was – I know Jonathan Arthur was so mad at me when I did that. Did the Sleep No More one, but luckily we'd already done the Box one.
So prior to the Box, but presumably after you come back, is the Donkey Show.
Yeah, so exactly. So then, you know, I would just dabble in theater, and I always felt very confident. Like the thing that Diane and I, if you grow up in New York at that time, and anyone who grows up in New York, like you go to nightclubs when you're, you know, 15 and 16 years old. Like it's a very weird thing where, you know, then all these people move to New York, they want to go to clubs, and you're like, that's for like high school kids.
Right?
Yeah, you know, you're... So we were always very cocky, like at nightclubs, like the whole Red Rebel, none of that stuff ever sort of fazed me. So, you know, I was like, that hip hop show, we did it in a nightclub actually at first. We did it at the Red Zone, which was the coolest club in New York also. Like it was, I've always been confident to go into these clubs and be like, you know, I know how you work, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Donkey Show was the same thing. We did it at a nightclub, El Flamingo. And
where was that located?
That was 21st Street. Now there's a huge like building there. It's very sad. I was just there recently with my kids. I was like, we used to do a show here. Now there's like a 30 story.
How old are your kids?
13 and 10.
13 and 10. And there, it's two girls, right?
Two girls.
Into theater? Or are they like, no,
well, the older one is really into, well, it's hard for them because they really grew up in theater in a different way from the way I grew up. From the fan side, but you know, they saw, like, by the time they're like 3 years old, they saw Hair 50 times.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, they're 6 and 3, they've seen Porgy and Bess 50 times. You know what I mean? And I just think they were from such, you know, they didn't know that you didn't go through the stage door. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To enter a show. Do you know what I mean? Like, they had such a weird experience of it. So I don't know how that's going to play out for them. I don't know if it's going to be like, you know, that's boring. You know what I mean? Because that's what they've done. Or I don't know if it's going to be like, that's what I know and that's what I love, if that makes sense. I mean, I think that's a little like Simon from The Box.
Yeah.
As he grew up and he's always sort of feels like, it's been a burden for him, actually. In a way, that's what I worry about for them. Is that, is it a burden if you've got a mother who's so successful? I don't know. You know, is it hard? Versus, and that's, I feel like Simon suffers from that. Mm. Like, you know, it's always like, is this Roger the Hammer?
Right.
Yeah.
Wait, so when does, so the you do the Donkey Show.
So we did the Donkey Show in like 19, actually, truthfully, the Donkey Show we started at Pianos, when it was the piano store.
Cool.
So there were literally pianos in the front, and we took, there was a little back room. And we're the ones who cut it open, actually, and turned it into like a venue like that.
Cool.
Literally with a sawzall, like that. So then that show was a big hit downtown, which means, I don't know what it means. It means 50 people a night would come see it. And we were, there was a place called the Pink Pony, which was like the cool like coffee bar. Uh-huh. That was literally like, it was terrible. I mean, the LES wasn't the LES that you guys know at all. It was like the Pink Pony was the only thing. Like that was the, you talk to old LES people, oh yes, the Pink Pony. That was the one cool place there. So they would get dressed in the Pink Pony because there was no dressing rooms at the piano store. And we made it a benefits because they'd parade down Ludlow Street.
Oh, cool.
And so this girl would come out. So we had Titania. We dressed her like in pasties and thigh-high boots and little hot pants. And the traffic would stop and everybody would scream like, what the fuck's going on?
Right.
And she would be walking down the street.
Great advertising.
Yeah, exactly. So all those things became opportunities. All those. I mean, that's the thing that I enjoy. It's like anything that seems bad, it's like, actually, that's good. That's a chance to do the opposite. So,
and did you, you learn the sort of like combination nightclub theater, would you say, like at the Donkey Show, or is that sort of just part of the whole progress?
Well, like I said, I've never, I always understood clubs just because we were so cocky at clubs. But then when I did the Donkey Show, Donkey Show was the first of pianos, then we did it at the Pyramid Club on Avenue A. Then Jordan Roth saw it.
You know, I know Jordan.
So Jordan saw it, and he actually auditioned to be in it. We're like, Jordan, sorry. And he was like, well, then I'll produce it. So then Jordan helped us take it to the El Flamingo, the club on 21st Street. So at the El Flamingo, I became very close with the owner of the club, whose name is John Steele. So he's like from a great sort of Italian-American family that, you know, ran the Copacabana. Like they are...
Oh, wow.
Legends in nightlife. So I would just be with John. He'd just talk about how nightclubs worked. And, you know, this was at a time, I think, nightclubs, it was just beginning, like, celebrities were, I don't know, it was a different kind, like the more Paris Hilton kind of celebrity. Mm-hmm. Like, just who was a celebrity for celebrity's sake, as opposed to, let's say, a real star. So he was kind of disgusted. He was like, why? It's all just celebrities and four speakers and a DJ. He's like, that's not what a club is. He's like, the Copa was about a show. So he loved the Donkey Show. So I feel like my whole life, it was working with these hip-hop kids or these, you know, Harley Davidson guys who all were like really wanting to do shows. They're like the last, like the guys you would not think. Like it was always working with people who wanted to do shows who weren't at all, you know, MFAs or, you know, like legitimate people, if that makes sense. The kind of people you would think, well, this person does not want to do it. Like, honestly, I wish you could, I wish I could bring those Harley Davidson guys in here. Because I think when I said that, I think Diane was like kicking me. Like, I was like, hey, would you like to do a show at the at your bar? And I think that was crazy. But then they were like, oh my God, we'd love to do that. And with these hip hop kids, we'd love to do that. And with this guy, who you would be the last guy you think that's like, club would wear a bulletproof vest, you know, had like five guys, literally Paulie, you know what I mean? Like all those guys sitting around him, sitting there like, you know, every cliche, but like so sensitive, so into it. And his whole connection was, for a while he was Hal Prince's bodyguard. He would always tell us these stories.
Wow. Yeah. So see, like, I like hear these stories and I just want to be living in this time period.
But
I
this feel time like... period is happening all the time. Yeah. It's just you're going through it. I guess, but I think you're legitimized, so you're going from Columbia, but you're, in a way,
I'm not legitimized.
But if you're legitimized because you had that, but that this is happening all the time. You know what I mean? Like, where was The Box? But three idiots, me, Simon, and Richard. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was nothing. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like,
now Joshua goes, yeah, I worked at The Box. And people go, you worked at The Box. Can you get me into The Box? I'm like, oh, Josh.
It was more like, I mean, that didn't exist. Who would ever think it was a good idea? I went with Diane. I was like, it was Richard, because Richard had gone to school with Diane at Columbia. You know, Richard has an MFA from Columbia, too. He was in the year below.
Directing.
It's the year below Diane. And Diane was always like, this kid's fucking crazy. I love this kid. I always hear about Richard. And then he called Diane. He's like, you know, I know you do the Donkey Show, you know, I'd like to have you. I didn't really know. I was like, you and Randy should come see our new club. So we saw the club tiny. I was like, why the fuck would we ever want to do a thing?
Had the construction part happened already?
They had just gotten the lease. No. There had been no construction. They had just gotten the lease. It was like literally still a sign factory. Everyone's working at the sign factory. I don't even know. The lease might not have been signed, but we went there with Richard and she was like, this is so small. Why would we ever do anything here? And I was like, I think it could be cool. I don't know. So like Diane, you know, went that way. And I was like, oh, let's do even more weird stuff. But I just, my point is like, it wasn't like there was a path to doing things like, you know, the box.
Right.
You know, in a way, House of Yes, the box sort of cleared the path for House of Yes. But the box was much more an aberration than all these sort of things that have happened since then.
I mean, there's so much we could talk about the box. But one thing that I've always sort of been curious about was what the most original like intention of it was before it existed when you guys were sitting there on paper. Like what was the thing you were trying to create?
Richard and Simon, so they were friends before and they really wanted to do like regular plays, believe it or not. Like Simon's real background was like as a director of these kind of off Broadway shows aspiring to be a Broadway director.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, actually Richard and I were much more avant-garde than Simon. As Simon will tell you right now, like Simon's the most traditionalist. We're always like, no, we can go, you know, much crazier.
right, push it.
Oh my God. So, you know, Simon's really funding most of it. And he and Richard were working on it, and that's what they were coming up with. But at the time, I was doing this show called Beecher's Madhouse in Las Vegas, which was like this variety show. And I was like, variety, like structuring this way. And then that really started to appeal to Simon, because as opposed to doing like a traditional play, I always make fun of Simon. He literally, when the office or the bus, we'd have Oyama, who is someone who worked at Ensemble Studio Theater. Because Simon, his dad, was a huge supporter of Ensemble Studio Theater. Oh. So Simon's from a very traditional theater background. And then we started doing we got interested in variety. Like they flew out and saw my show in Vegas. And,
How did you get into variety with that show?
Because I did the Donkey Show. So once I did the Donkey Show, the guy loved the club owner loved the Donkey Show, and he was like, I don't want to wear this bulletproof vest anymore. I just want to have these bachelorettes come scream and be happy and not do hip-hop parties anymore. It's like, here's the keys. I'm making so much money off the Donkey Show. Because he was making so much money off the bar. I was like, this is terrible.
Right.
I am literally supporting this guy. But in a way, it was great. He gave me the keys, and we started doing all these weird shows. And suddenly, I became like this. We had like a mini fringe festival going on there, because anyone who wanted to do a show, like, sure, do a show here. You know, I'll keep the bar, or the owner will keep the bar. You know, I just kept the place busy, because you just meet people, and I like to support them. You know, I was always interested in sort of supporting other artists, if that makes sense. Like, I still have that strain in me a little bit, which, again, you know, some people don't have. Like, I don't think Jonathan Arthur come from that place. You know what I mean? In the sense that they didn't grow up like doing shows on the street in the Fringe Festival. You know what I mean? Like, they're much smarter in terms of understanding the business, but I'll do something stupid just because they're like, I think it's a great idea.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. So we were just doing all these things, and then Richard and Simon just, you know, they wanted to, you know, I met Richard with Diane, but they wanted to meet me and talk about how does the Donkey Show work? It's like, well, you went to pick Jonathan Arthur's brains.
Yeah.
You know, they would like be like, we want to meet you. And I would meet a million people, and then there was something about those two guys. I was like, I like those guys. Like, and that's how I met Beecher. Is like, he came to me, and I was like, oh my God, I like this guy. This guy has this hustler in him that I know he's going to succeed. So I feel like I've been pretty good at always like meeting these people, like, oh my God, that guy's gonna succeed. So Beecher's Madhouse was a very successful show. We did it at Supper Club, then it got picked up at the Hard Rock and ran for like 5 years at the Hard Rock in Las Vegas. Then it's in, you know, it's just been all over. It's in Los Angeles, at the Roosevelt, blah, blah, blah. So
was the box the smash hit that it is when it opened, or was it a struggle
like
from
day one that thing took off? It's funny, sometimes you have those hits, like Donkey Show was pretty much the same thing. Like when you have a hit, it kind of there's a I also work, you know, when I was doing all that internet stuff, I got to work with a lot of like music and entertainment executives because they were all interested. Like, we want to invest. You know, they thought they're all going to make a fortune. And there was one of them who would always say, a hit acts like a hit, smells like a hit. Like, you sort of know what a real hit is almost immediately. You can work to make a thing that's not a real hit into a semi-hit if you're a really good producer and you're smart, but there's like a Sleep No More, there's like a Donkey, like those are like hits that just like out of the gate, the box, you know, that Club 12, frankly, although I was too young, like I look back on that, I'm like, man, if I were me now and I had that, I would have made a fortune. But what happened was the Schuberts came in, they were like, we want to do a workshop, and I was like young, I didn't know what was going on, so I was like trusting them, but they didn't know what to do with it, do you know what I mean? It was like having, you know, this lightning, and they didn't know what to do with it. You know, because it was so cutting edge. And so anyway, so yes, Box was all in work. Anything that was a hit was like a hit day one.
So now you're starting to become the main immersive guy, I guess, that's around.
Yeah.
Thought that way by a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, just because, it's more like, I'd say, just because I don't even know what it is to be immersive.
Yeah, immersive is the best word for exactly. But people use that word.
I just think I am a little bit, it's like, in everything, I was like a little, like I had done the Donkey Show. So then the Box people came to me. I had done the Box. So then I talked to the Sleep No More people. Actually, the Sleep No More people were fans of the Donkey Show.
That's the transition I was going to ask. Because it seemed like nobody was a better fit than you for bringing a show like that over with just your history. Is that what was appealing or?
For them. Yeah. I mean, I think that was what was appealing for them. And that was what was appealing for me. Because I was like, I know how to do the show. Like everyone else is like, we don't know how to do it. We're nervous. Do we do it in Brooklyn? Do we do it? You know, they had all these questions. I mean, frankly, Jonathan Arthur at that point, it was like, you know, everyone wanted to do it, but I had done these sort of underground shows and done a kind of thing with no marketing. Like, I just had experience. So every time you have experience, you're just ahead of people. And there's nothing trumps experience. You know what I mean? And I mean that failures and successes. Right. And that's the thing, I think, for me, just from a scientific background, truly, it's ingrained in me, failures are key. If you just succeed, you're not going to discover anything. So actually, I am so failure, you know, based. Like, I love failing because that's when you actually learn something, if that makes sense.
I've heard that the fundraising for Sleep No More was really hard because that's an impossible show to describe, or I can only imagine it was like that process of going around saying, we're going to buy this or rent this whole big massive building and convert it. It's going to be a hotel, but it's going to be masks and all these things. What was the, can you describe sort of that challenge a little bit of making it,
well,
bringing it?
You know, when we first went out, we would put $0. We would have no marketing line. So you'd show it to any intelligent person. They'd be like, and now all intelligent investors think they're so smart because they would look at a budget and be like, you have no marketing. You're a complete amateur. You have no idea. Marketing is the key to the whole thing. You need to have 25% in marketing. And I had this thing. I feel like I've told this, but you already know the story. I love the story, though. Where, I don't know, I think Jonathan was also there, where Punch Drunk was so upset how we were doing it. They called the English National Theater and I had to have a meeting with the English National Theater, and they were telling me, you have to have marketing, you have to do it. Like, they literally, like, called their parents.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, actually, no. Because then they said, well, you should try and develop something where people can, if they like the show, tell their friends. And I was so sassy on the phone. I was like, you know, I said, I could do that. I could try and develop a way for people who like the show to talk to their friends. But there's this thing that's, like, worth billions of dollars. It's called Facebook. And it already exists. And if people like the show, they can tell their friends in a much better and easier way than anything I'll ever develop. So I said, I'd rather take the money that you're telling me to put $800,000. I'd rather take that $800,000 and make the show $800,000 more awesome, so when people like it, then they can use Facebook to tell their friends. You know what I mean? So I was really so beat.
Was
like
the mask thought of as something that would be shared as much as it was before you guys, before it opened?
Well, that was pretty obvious. Like, I think Punch Drunk had developed the show in England. They'd done a small version, and then, you know, sort of I brought it to ART with Diane, and then we did it in New York, and each time we tried to make it bigger, but I think they had never done a thing where you gave the mask to the audience, which was unbelievable to me. They would take the mask. Not only is it disgusting to me that we would, like, I'm a germaphobe, that you would, like, reuse the mask, but it was just, like, the ultimate marketing opportunity. And it's something that I learned from De La Guardia. I remember when we did Donkey Show. This is a simple and stupid, but, like, they used to, in De La Guardia, drop these little toys, not Forza Bruta, De La Guardia.
The one before it?
The one before. And they would drop these, and everyone would take those little toys and, like, put them in their rooms. And they were so nondescript. So then in Donkey Show, we were like, let's do a drop, and we'll drop these big butterflies, and on it, I'll say the Donkey Show. So for a while, people would keep all this, like, we'd go into people's houses and then have, like, a Donkey Show. They'd be like, oh my God, awesome, you saw the Donkey Show. So I always knew I wanted some sort of takeaway that people would put in their house, and everyone who saw it, again, all these things are sort of incredible marketing, nostalgia. I mean, just on every level, it's just nice to have a keepsake. That's sadly the
I think I had that mask for like 2 years, and I was like, why am I still holding on to this mask?
I know,
but
people hold on to it. It's weird.
Yeah.
And then people would see it. And some people would lay it out, especially in their living room, so everyone would see it as a way to talk to people about their experience.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, the mask was very important to me. Always.
So you did a dance show. Does Queen of the Night come out of the thought of I want to play around with circus, or did it come around from another angle?
So Queen of the Night, so this guy A.B. Rosen owns the Paramount Hotel, and he was just interested in talking to people about different ideas for what to do with the Diamond Horseshoe. And he must have talked to, I don't know, 100 people. And then I think I gave him the craziest idea, and he's kind of a crazy guy, so he's like, I love that idea. I was like, we're going to make the ultimate modern opera, and what opera is like getting the greatest designers, greatest musicians, greatest actors, greatest, you know. I was like, we're going to have the greatest of everything and put it in your basement of your hotel. I was like, I love it. So he helped us develop that show, and we just got everyone. I mean, it was like such an embarrassment of riches of people sort of working on that show.
Yeah, we saw it when it was still like, it was maybe the third preview, yeah. or I think it was even earlier. And I mean, the show was really cool, but I really remember the bathrooms.
Oh my God, incredible.
The bathrooms were insanely amazing.
The backstage tour, maybe not backstage, but the room.
Oh, yeah, because Kevin, who was it, Kevin Beverly?
Yeah,
it showed us around.
Oh, you're friends with Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's crazy. It's funny, I just went there. Asher just went there with me the other day, and I was like reminiscing. I mean, how much craziness. At work, it does.
I was like, wait, you could, this like older woman, and this was before we were dating, and I was in love with Josh, and we were sitting at this like booth, and this older couple was sitting with us, and Kevin Beverly comes over, he's like, are you in love? Mm-hmm. And I, in my head, I was like, yes. And then Josh goes, no, we are coworkers. I was like, rude. And then the lady next to me got pulled for the like milk bath, mm-hmm. and she came back, I was like, oh. Like, I, for once, having these amazing experiences. I'm sitting here, like, wishing, yeah, on a bad date. But it was amazing. And, like, yeah, but I was so happy that Kevin showed us all the rooms because I didn't get to see any.
No, it was deep. And when you think about milk bath, I just think I like to do stuff where I'm nervous also that it might fail. Because that whole idea that we were, I mean, you know what happens in the milk bath.
Right, like, get the person undressed and get in the milk bath.
Yeah, right?
I know.
So, like, I was like, holy shit.
This and this was like an older woman. I was like, you did that?
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God.
And it was so deep because, you know, it was all time then. So like 5 women would show up in the milk bath with, and they would talk about like womanly things. And I would say, what are you talking about? They're like, we will never tell you, Randy. So I don't know what the hell went on in that milk bath.
Oh my God. Truthfully. That's so cool. Then you guys gave
people
them.
People come back. You'd see them come back, and they were covered in tears.
Tears.
Yeah, so I don't know what was going on with those women about like rites of passage, because that's what that's all sort of based on, magic flute, this rite of passage of this girl. So it was weird. I mean, it was like, is it a story? Is it a narration? Is it a circa? You know, what is it, dinner? I don't know. You know, it's like, I think what was interesting to me is like that was open to so many interpretations of what it was, but it was all done on such a high level and, you know, in interesting ways that I just think it was exciting.
So something that we struggle with our show that we is like called Slumber, but it's like a, we did a House of Yes, and it was a circus and dance and comedy and gore, and because one girl murders all her friends, mm-hmm. and but it's funny, and like because it was almost so many things, it was hard to talk about like mm-hmm. what it was.
Yeah.
Did you find that with Queen of the Night, because it was so many things, it almost was harder to figure out the way into the show, or was it cool because it was so many different things that people could grasp onto it?
I mean, listen, you've asked. There's many sort of profound quandaries in terms of making a show. And it's funny because people, you'll read it in reviews. I find that I read reviews just because, you know, they're sort of the essences of.
Right.
And you'll see a writer write, you know, it was too vague and also too specific. You know what I mean? It's like these antitheses that actually you try and like rationally say, but, and you know, I'm a scientist, so I'm like, how do you, what's the proper, is it 3/4 of a cup of that? And I put in 7/8 of a cup of that. Like, I really don't know the answer to that.
It's hard.
It's like, it's, I think that's the magic that makes a show work. And you sort of, I believe in like workshopping a show, like we're doing this thing, seeing you. So mm-hmm. I did Seeing You. And I think Seeing You is a perfect example of having a million different things. And they're actually all awesome on their own, but seeing you right now, the mix is like off.
Right,
it was like,
right.
Actually, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we have to like, and actually we have all the material, but actually it might have been less of this and more of that, or more of, you know what I mean? It's like how you get it to a point that people, and also you're always playing with where people are coming from. So people, their expectations. So one of the things in Queen of the Night, I was like, I really want to not have this be like Sleep No More. It was really like, because it was like, well, you're going to use masks. I'm like, I'm definitely not using masks.
Right.
And it's funny because we had a bunch of stewards from Salim Namour, who came to work at Queen of the Night because, you know, they just like to do a different thing. So they would be there and they'd be like grumpy and standing there, you know, and watching people. I was, no. This is the opposite of Salim Namour. This is like friendly. This is like, hi, you know, I love you. You know what I mean? And it was just so interesting to try and flip everything. It was even when we were building the entrance, you know, we put all this like flex neon because everyone's like, I don't know, people want it to be dark. It's like, no, please, because I want people to know from the start we are not going to Sleep No More. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And I think all things like seeing you suffered a lot because people would see it and be like, well, this is not as detailed as Sleep No More, or we can't move around. Like, it's like you're always dealing, and then we would have people who were Queen of the Night fans who'd be like, well, this wasn't any fun. There was no drinks here. There was no food here. Do you know what I mean? Even though there was never going to be because there was supposed to be like a workshop of it, and We didn't have a liquor license, so. But, you know, it's just interesting, like, hearing, you know, sort of feedback. And people are coming in with expectations. So this is a long way of answering your question. I think it's about the audience's expectations. Mm-hmm. And if you can get them to a place of complete innocence, mm-hmm. then it lives in an unlabeled
world. That's so true. The people who liked our show were the people who had no idea anything about it. The people who were like, I thought it was going to be a circus show.
Exactly.
Were like, where was the circus?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things that always in the... In talking about Sleep No More, we try not to, you know, in the marketing, like, try not to label it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately now, Sleep No More is like an albatross. It's, like, too big. And everyone now compares everything to Sleep No More. Like, mm-hmm. people, there's not going to be another moment for a long time where you have the innocence that people walked into Sleep No More.
No.
Because it's, like, it came up with seeing you. Because there were people, like, who love seeing you, who, like you said, who, like, saw it unlabeled and were like, you should do this in Chicago. Because in Chicago, you know, no one's seen anything like it. So they're not going to go, oh, well, Sleep No More had this, or, oh, Queen of the Night. You know what I mean? They're just going to see it on its own weird terms, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense.
It's a tough question.
Yeah.
And you're dealing, like I said, with history. You're dealing with just the ingredients on their own.
Mm-hmm. And then I think I read an article maybe like a year or two ago about a show, a magic show that you were working on.
Yeah, so that's at 57th Street. Yeah. So we're trying to do something with Matt. I mean, just because I like Chiffo, you know, was in, Steve Chiffo, works at the box, was in Queen of the Night. And I always just liked the magic. I just liked what it did to the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, again, as a scientist, like, grab their attention and, you know, brought them to a place of wonder. Do you know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. all the things you want. Which is like, you know, circus does that at its best. But there's something about magic that just really interested me, and we hadn't done it and it hadn't sort of been done in a way with the kind of crowd in the luxury environment, if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And in a weird way with one-on-ones. So we started working on that in 57th Street, and there's a lot of magic still in it. It's not the essence of the place isn't magic, but it's like a lot of that space, which is going to open hopefully soon. There's a lot of department of buildings and stuff we're dealing with, but that'll open soon and that'll have a lot of magical qualities to
magic.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of what your creation, writing, thinking of originating material process is? Because you're talking about shows that have dance, magic, circus, theater. Like when you're sitting at home or in your office, the awesome view, like how does it start and what are you sort of focusing on or thinking about?
Yeah, it's funny because I have all these sort of unstructured ideas of, you know, for shows. Things that I go, oh my God, there's a show in that, which we all have. Like, you want it, I'm like, oh my God, that would be such a great show. And sometimes I'll write them up or I'll write them down and think that I put it in a place where I'll remember it. And then you don't remember it. You know, you have no idea where it is. So there's that part of my life. And then I think that's just like a sort of a bubbling sort of cauldron. Maybe it's like, you know, when you go to a buffet and there's like the soup crock. So like that kind of like a soup crock of stuff that's bubbling around.
A crock pot?
Well, I don't know, like you go to like a sort
like
of
a
big old black thing, you know, that has like soup in it. But it doesn't really take form until you put it into either a bowl or a cup or whatever it's gonna be. Until someone actually
sticks like the garnish of it.
Say it again.
And you put like some little garnish
on
top.
Well, yeah, that's nice. That's
then it's
nice.
Like a
so that's
real
how you
presentation.
Do it. So that's what I'm saying. That's how you do it. So that's my point. It's like, I got this crock pot, let's call it. And it starts boiling around in there, but like, it doesn't mean anything until it comes out and either gets put in the cup or the bowl and someone decides to put oyster crackers on it or like whatever. And that happens when someone presents the bowl. You know what I mean? So the bowl is usually like some real estate opportunity because I don't do stuff in traditional ways. Or, you know, if someone might say, hey, Randy, here's this theater. I'd like to do a traditional thing. And then I start thinking about how I'm going to ladle that shit out. And it's like a clam chowder where, like, you know, I reach in and maybe I'm going to get, you know, the potato or lots of potatoes and lots of little clam. Like, but all those like, things are in that.
Where are the noodles?
You know what I mean? Like, right. It's like that. So I don't know. Like, and then you crock it out and you're like, oh, well, for this thing and for that audience, actually, they don't even want any clams. So let's just focus on the other part of it. I don't know if that means anything to you.
No, that's great.
That's just, but I think that's what it is. It's like, I've got this stuff, it's constantly on a low boil and it's just waiting to express itself. And then once it starts to express itself, you might say, oh shit, I actually, that clam chowder, let's, you know, water it down or add garnishes or whatever. But it's when something happens. And I think, you know, I'm getting older now. I've done so many things. So it's like, I'm always looking to like how to structure a company in a different way. So I think what I'm interested in now, and again, it's sort of what I was saying at the start of this about feeling a little bit, you know, disconnected. I mean, like, I feel like my kids are inheriting the world, and that kind of instinct you have when you saw it fresh.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I try to keep it, but, you know, invariably it goes away. So I'm more interested in finding people now and helping them, if that makes sense, like developing them, which is really what I've always done. Like, it comes back to even when I had that club, and I was just like, I was just helping this group, helping that group. Like, I have a lot of good karma out there in the sort of theater world of just trying to be, you know, support. And I think even at the box, I think we're pretty good about doing stupid things to support shows.
For every organization I've ever worked for, I think the box has more of that family post-supportive atmosphere than almost anywhere else.
Exactly. Well, I think because Richard, Simon, and I all came from that place of doing downtown shows, which is a very different place from if you've come from trying to do things commercially. It's like a different mindset. And I think I live somewhere in between because I get it. Like, it's commercial. Let's go for it. You know how to put the money in and structure it. But I just think to find something new and original and to develop something, that takes a lot of support. And, you know, I don't look at it like I'm like a vulture and I'm just going to come and take the things that are, you know, good things. Like, I want to be part of the building because that's the part I actually liked. Like, that's why I did. That's what I was saying when I started this. I was like, I'm talking to these bankers now. I'm like, it's crazy because I didn't do it to talk. It was really, it's so incredible because it was never a thought that that would happen to me, if that makes sense. Like, whereas those guys really want to be sort of moguls or... So I don't even think, like, when you're like, oh, you do immersive. I don't have a sense that I'm a leader in immersive theater, but I do have a sense that I've been doing this a long time, and I know a lot of people. And, you know, I have a place now where I can get money, basically, and support to do lots of different shows. So that's where I'm at right now in my life, is, like, how can I, you know, do 10 shows at once and, like, support, you know, like, you guys or whoever, you know, like, say, like, hey, let's do this and give you whatever, like, rather than pick my brain, which I always think is like, you're not going to get anything. Maybe you will, but it's like more like, okay, I'm in it with you and let's make those hard decisions. Because when you say pick your brain, it's easy for me to be like, and do this, bye. You know, But you know something? The truth is, sometimes, and I said this before, I feel like I'm pretty consistent, so that's the only good thing here, is sometimes those things that seem like the worst ideas are actually the biggest opportunities. Like, trust me, when you're talking about how was it raising money for Sleep No More, raising for 100 rooms, you run around in a mask, maybe you'll see a show, maybe you won't. That, on paper, sounds like a bad idea. Like, I could have said, that's a bad idea. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, so in a way, the fact that it's a bad idea is what is almost a competitive advantage.
Right.
Because who the hell would do that? You know what I mean? Like, only an idiot would do that, and that's your opportunity. So I used to say that with Simon and Richard all the time. Like, only an idiot. It's funny, because when we were doing the box, we were first raising an amount of money, and we ended up raising, like, three times as much money. And I would always be like, actually, I feel better raising more money. It's like the counterintuitive thing, because if we don't raise enough money, this might not be awesome enough to... We put so much money into that little place. It was so stupid. It was so stupid. But that's actually what was smart. Because no rational person would do that. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
totally.
So, like, that's like, actually, if I really got... Because with Simon and Richard, they might have sat down with me if I was just me sitting at the Donkey Show and said, we're going to do this. I'd be like, well, that doesn't make any sense because blah, blah, blah. But actually, it was that stupidity is what made it so awesome.
So, I'm sorry that we're taking so much of your time, but there were two shows that I really wanted to ask you about that are sort of in parts, different parts of your history. But you were a dramaturg on a Cirque du Soleil show
at one point
for Alma Luna.
That is correct.
I'm just wondering if you can talk about, like, what it's like to go from being somebody who's essentially, like, producing and directing and running these shows to being a cog on a massive machine.
Cog is exactly the word. I really enjoy that because it's like a lot of pressure when you're doing everything on a show. And there, I mean, it's such a well-produced, I mean, it's such a, I mean, I think Cirque du Soleil is incredible because I've had only sort of great experiences being an artist within it. I'm not going to comment whether what we made was great or, you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't even matter. I'm just talking about being there, the way they treat you is fantastic. You guys ever, do you ever do any develop, like when you're in the creation mode with them? So I talk about that all the time where the way they create their shows is, you know, for like one of their tent shows, like they, for 2 years, you're really working hard on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you sit down at a table and there's like 14 people there from the jump street. And it's, I know this from my own readings of, you know, theater history. Like, that's the way the Russians would do play. Like, the way Americans do plays is very weird. Like, a playwright does it, and then you glom on something else, and then the lighting designer is the last guy. Whereas, like, the Russians were always talking about, we'd all sit in the room and talk about the play, and the lighting designer would be, so we'd understand the spirit of it, you know, fully. It wouldn't be like this complete thing. So that's the way they do it at Cirque. Like, you're sitting there with the props person, the whatever person. And Diana and Scott Pask are working on it. So Scott Pass is a very big set designer. So Scott, I remember, was being driven crazy. I think he was doing Book of Mormon.
Right, because he didn't normally do theater.
Yeah, so he's like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to fucking sit here. I'm like, here with the like props person, thinks of like, you know, because usually like the set designer often comes in like the second, like he's usually pretty high up on the hierarchy. Right. The props person is like, you know, much lower. But, you know, you'd go around the room and 14 people would comment. So it was, like, in a way maddening, I think, for people like Scott and Diane. But for me, I was like, this is so cool. This is so weird. Like, because I've always been interested in more of a flat structure. Like, I'm obviously, when you do an immersive show, it's not hierarchical because it's not structured narrative in the same way. So I'm interested in, like, oh, this could be a weird one-on-one. It has nothing to do with the story. Now you could do, like, a weird, you see what I'm saying? Totally. So it really appealed to me. So I had an amazing time. And they're like, great. And I think Scott and Diane at the end loved it too. I think at the beginning they were just like, they were so used to like go, you know, like their own thing. Whereas I was like, oh my God, I'm so out of my comfort zone. What do you guys got for me? And they start talking French, you know, or like
right.
with the Chinese people. Like, it, the whole thing was so weird and crazy.
Was that all in Montreal at their headquarters?
You would do all the headquarters. So we'd go up to Montreal. It was so great. Loved Montreal. Like everything about it, I loved. Yeah. I loved everything about that.
I could get to get out of the city.
Oh my God, Montreal's so awesome.
It is. Yeah. It really is. We were there for, well, we try to go for the ENC graduation.
Yeah.
And just spend some time there.
How do you know Kevin just from?
From being like 14 together in like Vermont summer camps.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Circus Marcus?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't do
Have
Circus
Marcus.
Sure.
Nice.
He's on the board now.
Oh, you're on the board?
Yeah.
Yeah, Lauren Antler, do you ever hear her? So she used to work, but she got cut from the squad, but you know, we were talking with her. But I always knew Circus Marcus because we know Gypsy, obviously, so well, and her kids would go there, and she'd always be like Natalie. And
her Catholic. Daughter is now Alaska, she's like the clown, and she does Chinese pole,
Totally. So Gali in Alaska, you know, they're friends with our daughter, so you know,
And
Mason.
Yeah, Mason.
You know, was always Mason, talking to Circus Marcus, so we'd see it all the time because it always traveled through. I forget where we'd see it.
Comes to Waltham?
Waltham. Yeah. Thank you.
Waltham.
At that weird mansion in Waltham. Yeah. So we always see it in Waltham.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
So the other show that I really want
to
talk about.
I can't express to you how much I love Circus Marcus. I think it's so cute.
It's amazing,
you go
right?
Get the autographs from the kids. You talk to all the kids. It's great. Also, I mean, I have a whole thing also where I don't like to rip people off. So I love it when you go to this, like, I used to love Big Apple Circus. Like, you go to Ringling Brothers, like, $25 for a hot dog, and there's like, $1.50.
I know. You know what I mean? I know.
Why do they have to do that? Why do they have to turn everything into an opportunity to gouge people?
So you did a show, a Peter Pan immersive show.
Yeah.
I don't really know a lot about it other than it sounds like, you started talking about earlier, like, the perfect cocktail of things, like an immersive children's Peter Pan.
Well, it's funny. It's a really interesting idea for a show. So I was like the, I don't know what they call them, the creative director. So they came to me. They had this idea to do Peter Pan. I was like, I think it would be really cool to do it that you're in the sort of Darling Family Museum. Like, they've made this memorial to their kids who've never returned from Neverland. So it's like all the information they could have, and you sort of you'd meet the parents who are like kind of the proprietor. So you'd go around and you'd wear like these headphones and you'd say, and they'd say, this is an artifact of a crocodile. By this size of this tooth, the crocodile is this size. Or this is an artifact of Captain Hook. Like all these things. And here are the theories of where our children are, because it's like in some dimension they can't get. And you listening on the headphones at some very, you know, drone of a voice. And then you'd hear, psst, psst, like this little voice come over, psst, psst, over this way. see the exit sign, you know, go through that, go through that, even though it says like employees only. So you go to the employees only, and then you go in the back, and it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark, where that's where they keep the secret window that the kids walk through.
So oh, you walk through, I love Fear Fans. I'm like dying.
So you walk through the secret window, like they sprinkle fairy dust on you. You meet like one of the, you know, fairies, and they're trying to get you over there because they need you to help, you know, get the kids free, the lost boys. So you go through the window, and you literally go through the slide and, you know, through, you know, lights and all this crazy shit. And then spread before you was Neverland. Like, you look and like, holy shit, because it was a 50,000 square foot venue. So that was the idea for it. And the people all loved it. They're like, this is going to be the greatest fucking thing in the world. But I think that show, what happened was, it was producers who never done a show. Mm. They were like movie producers. And it's very interesting, like the difference between movie people and TV people, theater people, theme park people. Like, it's funny, everyone thinks you're all the same, but actually you're really different.
So different.
So they, what they did was like this weird, talk about like a mix. Like, they built a full scale replica ship that was so unbelievable in its detail, but then they used all the money making that. So like everything else was just like sheets. And I don't know, it was a very weird, they just didn't quite get it. Like, because at first they were like, we'll spend any budget. And then like, of course, no one's going to spend any budget. So it just got mixed up between being super detailed and then super imaginative. And I think actually either way would have worked. They could have made it less, because Peter Pan's all about imagination.
Right.
And we actually did a workshop in New Jersey that was like great because we had nothing there. And it was like so imaginative. It was so funny because with the Chinese lady who was backing the whole thing, came up to me after, just like, why was this so different from the one in New York? And I was like, because in New York, it was all imagination.
Right.
So I think there's still a great idea in it, but, you know, and I'm on record with them saying, like, I was just very frustrated with how it happened. But in a way, it's frustrating because of two things. One is I live in America. So, like, they sort of purchased this idea, and then the expression of it was sort of up to them, if that makes sense. So it really led me to, I don't know, like, I like to be very collaborative, or at least I think I do, but I just wanted to have more control. I was like, you know something?
Yeah.
And that in a way is how I felt at the Cirque du Soleil show, where, and they're dealing with a totally different market, so they know much better their market, but I wish I could have just done, like, I think, you know, they have a lot of development people around it in terms of, and I enjoyed it all, and I really understood why they made the decisions they made, but they weren't necessarily the decisions, you know, I would have made. If that makes sense.
Totally. We usually wrap up with the same three questions for each of our guests.
How many guests have you guys had?
You're number 46.
That's a lot.
I know. And when we were at Smirkus, like, what was it, 2 weekends ago, these little girls came up to us and they're like, hi, Lindsay. And well, they really went to Josh, let's be real, because they're like, hi, Josh. Hi, Lindsay. And they're like, we fall asleep listening to your podcast
that's
every
so
night.
Cute.
I was like, oh my God, that's so cute. Make sure I don't swear. I'm put explicit.
Yeah, you got to cut out those F-bombs.
I drop them all the time. It's so bad. I was like, oh my God. Yeah, but we've been doing it for, I guess, a year, right?
Yeah, about a year, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
Love it.
It's the best excuse to talk to people who we've met a handful of times.
It's also good because we talked to so many different people, like in different areas, like really traditional to really contemporary. And like, I just love hearing about everyone's ideas and thoughts because it's like the most valuable.
Do you know producer's perspective? You must know his.
Yeah, yeah,
I listened to his episode before.
Oh,
because Ken also did a. He like was a guest speaker, and
at
he's
Columbia.
He's so interesting to me.
Yeah,
we tried to not have too much overlap with Ken's.
No, I
Ken's
know
guests.
It's weird though because I got so many things from Ken's podcast.
Really,
like, he's got a big following.
So many people. I can't express to you how many people are like, I heard your podcast. It was more than anything.
Like fan mail?
Yeah, like, no, we're not quite fan mail, but like, hey, I have a project or I have a, you know.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Fan mail would make it more exciting than it was. Just like a response.
Well, what were you telling me this morning? His last question is always like, what?
His last question is, what would you put in a Schubert Theater if they gave you?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's why I think I remember.
That's a perfect question for you because you're like, I don't really want the Schubert Theater.
Yeah.
I know. That's, everyone else is like, well, don't you want to just do like a normal, like, proscenium theater? I'm like, no, it's so not fun. It's like, it's so much more fun to have a space that you can just imagine whatever you want it to be, and then if it happens to be that, it's like, okay.
Right.
But if you get stuck in this, like, I have to be this one way, it's like so unexciting to me.
Yeah.
And that was when he was, because he was like, Randy said this answer that we always talk about. And everyone's always like, you're crazy. Like, why do you not want to, why do you not want to do a normal theater?
I don't know if I'll include, we'll see what we include. But one of the things that I like talking about with other guests is this idea that because theater uses text, it seems like the box that you can play in is really, really big because you can talk about anything. But coming from like circus and variety and experimental stuff, without text, it actually feels like the box is much bigger because you're not trying to fit into a whole bunch of preconceived notions of like what plays and musicals are. Even though plays and musicals feel like, oh, I can talk about anything and touch any topic, there's a lot of like preconceived ideas or limits. And like the circus sandbox these days, and I'm using circus in the same way like we're using theater or immersive, like a very broad definition of what it is, has always seemed to have like less structure, particularly as like tented shows are dying. So it's sort of like, what is the next version of it? Mm-hmm. In any case, we usually wrap up with three questions.
I thought that was building the question.
Oh, no, that was just me musing for a joke.
Welcome to my life with Josh.
That's good.
Yeah, it's okay. The amount of musing I've cut out of these podcasts is painful.
I thought you were going to lead to some question about
that. No, it's not a good question.
No, it's good. It's interesting about text and no text or, you know, dying forms. You know, when we all say they're dying.
Right.
I don't even know what it means to die.
Right.
There's always someone. I was
something
just talking
new.
About this, right? With that kid, talking about the horse and buggy. It's funny, I was biking through the park. I was like, damn, I wish they'd get rid of these horse and buggies.
Right?
Stink up the place. Yeah,
have you received a piece of advice in your life, good or bad, that's really stuck with you?
That's a good question. Good or bad advice? You know, I actually feel really bad in my life in that I never had a mentor. I think there's so many people like Diane, you know, really connected with like Anne Bogart and Andre Servan and Paul Sills. Like she's mentor, who like she's, you know, sort of studied with. And I've never really had a mentor. And I think it kind of shows in what I do because no one's ever said, oh, that's good or bad. I used to say that always about my parents. And in a way, I think this is a kind of mentorship. They never really had any comment. Like people would always be like, my mother says you can't dress like that or you can't. They didn't. I just would leave the house and whatever I was wearing, they had sort of no comment on. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So all my life, I've always felt like, wow, my parents never really commented on, you know, what I did. They would never tell me to do my homework. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and maybe it's because I was such an angel kid, but I certainly could have done many things, like writing thank you notes. I don't know. My wife was telling our kids, you have to write thank you notes. I was like, oh my God, my parents never told me to write thank you. Like, I was like, well, that's a really smart piece of advice. Right. You know, like things like that. I never did any of that stuff. Like on a personal level with anything. And that is kind of a answer in a weird way.
It's kind of freeing though when you don't have someone
yeah,
who
weird.
You're worried about their
no,
opinion.
No, I have no one who I, like my parents wouldn't show up. Like it would be like when I'd be playing these sports games, my parents would come together. My parents never came. So it was a kind of, like a kind of a neglect that was kind of actually fun and healthy.
Like liberating.
Yeah, yeah.
Second question is, for somebody who usually focuses more towards circus, but I'll open it up to live performance in general, is there a show or a book or a movie that you would recommend somebody who is a student of these topics read or see or watch?
That's a good question. I didn't go to any school and didn't have any mentor. I have so many books and things that mean a lot to me. Sometimes they don't mean, like if I said Artaud and I would say Signal Through the Flames, you know, you could read a lot of Artaud and you would be like, oh, Randy, what an ass for making me read this because it's truly, literally a madman's reading.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's a madman. But in a way, I would find the vibe of it. Like, I would just go into the vibe. I would go into it the way someone would enjoy music and just be like, wow, this guy's really fucked up. And I would just feel, I would so feel that idea of there's a signal. Like, this guy is burning. I mean, he's literally burning. But there's a signal coming through this, if that makes any sense to you. So, I mean, there's so many people like that. Oh, my God. I used to be able to rattle off my reading list of, like, Roland Barthes. I love for all the different ways we engage with, you know, material, like all these semiotic kind of. I have a gazillion of those. That's what's so funny. And I'd be hard pressed to say what the number one thing is, because it would matter who you are and where you are. I remember reading like Aristotle's Poetics, and I love that. The butcher translation of that, I love it. I love Francis Ferguson, the idea of a theater. So all those things are things that I sort of, I don't know how I found all these things. It would be like, British Francis Ferguson, he lists like 20 things, like, you know, and I'd be like, oh my God, I want to read that. So it's really like, and I'm still like that, like, you know, but I won't read it in the way some other people read it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'll read it and sort of go, oh, that's an interesting, or like one idea might be enough, and I'll read 300 pages and sort of skim over it, but it'll be like something that means a lot to me. So.
Nice.
The last question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast?
That's a good question too. You know, I'm not really interested in actually even people like me. I consider myself an outlier. I think you should have like that Harley dude, Jay Whitney from
Wisconsin.
From Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. I mean, someone like that who just, you know, there's no reason for him to do theater.
Right.
Like,
right.
I just think when you tap into some like incredible human impulse, there's no reason that he should have done that.
When you talk to those type of people too, it's like inspiring, because you're like, of course, art will never die. Like, theater is never going to die. Circus is never going to die, because like inherently people need it and they need stories it. And it's, want it. And I love talking to people who have nothing to do with it, but just love it.
Nothing whatsoever to do with it. And no conception this is going to lead to anything.
Or, right.
You know, just like, is interesting to him. And he was really happy because I was like, and I'll put your kids in the show. I don't know, it was like, it was so kind of wholesome in a weird Harley Barr kind of way.
Yeah, that's, you know, amazing. What I mean?
It was really interesting.
And you still talk to him?
I haven't talked to him. Oh my God. I'm trying to remember how I had some interactions with him. Someone died recently. Like, I think his mother died. This was probably 3 years ago. But we went there, God, it's probably been, you know, 20 years now.
So feel
but
like.
It's so like the way, it's so funny that, I don't know when Diane came to talk to your class, but it was like this crazy time in our lives where we were just so open. You know, we didn't have anything. We had no structure. So we're like, sure, we're friends with you. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
You know, you're like, oh, you know,
right, who?
You know, we're friends with you, or you know, like right. how that all shakes down. So yeah. I mean, a guy like that is interesting.
Yeah.
All those people I talked to, all those, like that guy who owned the club, who was
right.
Hal Prince's bodyguard.
Yeah. Those must be some cool stories that
those are cool stories. And it's also like, I don't know, it's just like, it's much wider than talking to Ken or me, or, you know, like, or, you know, any of the normal people, like the, whoever, Diane Quinn is taking over Cirque du Soleil, you know, like, you know, who cares?
You but
know?
Anyway, thank you so much
for doing this.
Nice to meet you, MMT.
That was our interview with Randy Weiner.
If you like the episode or like our podcast, please make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend. It's Thursday, right? It's almost the weekend.